Welcome to Manage Your Tools. Today's cast, Managerial Economics 101, 102, and 103. Reporting, delegation, and coaching. The questions this cast answers are, what is managerial economics? What does managerial economics mean for delegating? And what does managerial economics mean for coaching? If you want answers to these questions and more, keep listening.
Hey folks, if you're listening to this cast, you're probably a manager or want to be one. And if you haven't attended our Effective Manager course, I got to tell you, you're missing out on maybe our most popular product in terms of the number of people who come to trainings. We're going to coach you. We're going to teach you everything you need to know about the Trinity, about one-on-ones, about feedback, about coaching, about delegation, about rolling out those tools, taking your time doing it. We'll share with you the data we have on the various tools, and we'll tell you what to do, how to do it, when to do it, what to say. When we tell you to brief your people, we'll tell you exactly what to say. Why? Because that's what we would want if we were going to training. Not pie in the sky, not theories, but actually what to do. Hope to see you at a future EMC. We have public, in-person, and virtual events. You can sign up, or maybe you could convince your company to hire us to come in and train a bunch of managers all at once. It's actually cheaper to do it that way. Hope to see you there.
So, managerial economics. This is a fun topic. I'm excited for this one, Kate.
I am too. I think that there's some confluence here between a bunch of different ideas, which is one of the places I find our guidance really shines for me sometimes, just that we've got these other systems in which our work operates, and talking about our work within those systems is really valuable. I hope that other people have the experience of these conversations pinging their brain in other areas, that it strikes, you know, sparks of ideas in other areas of your brain about like what else is going on. We've talked about managerial economics before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In 2010.
Which is why some of those ideas might spark, right?
Absolutely.
We've kind of danced around the topic before.
We put out a cast in 2010 about assign work and reporting, which that was only one application of a fundamental organizational principle.
Mm-hmm.
Internal organizational systems are also an economy, and the rules of economics frequently apply to decisions organizations make internally. So we're going to cover four things in this discussion about managerial economics. First, managerial economics defined.
Mm-hmm.
Next, managerial economics in work reporting. Then, managerial economics in delegation. And finally, managerial economics in coaching. This is another cast where maybe the guidance that is applicable, the actionable guidance, isn't going to come in the first outline piece, y'all. So if you're the high D listener and mm-hmm. you want to skip straight to actions, this first managerial economic definition piece might not be exactly what you're looking for right at the start. But we are going to define
it. We need a bit of an on-ramp.
Yeah.
We totally are. There needs to be an on-ramp. I mean, it's, for lack of a better term, it's a heavy topic, mm-hmm. managerial economics. So we need to put down a heavy definition before we can start getting into what does that mean for you, our listener. Now, as Kate mentioned, we first introduced managerial economics to the Manager Tools community in 2010. So if you're new to us, go back and listen to one of our podcasts, which is Hall of Fame Guidance, called Assign Work and Reporting. Now, in that cast, my apologies, our guidance points it out, one specific example of the application of the concept. Now, that said, today, we're going to help you draw a much more broader conclusion. That is, managerial economics is much bigger than this one application which we used in our previous cast.
Right. Managerial economics is defined as the implementation of economic principles internally in organizations. Let's derive this idea from what we know. All organizations exist to serve society. In all but a very few societies, the fundamental nature of social exchange is capitalistic. Mm-hmm. This is not as popular an idea as it used to be.
Right.
But while capitalism is an idea, its existence is not. Even those people who decry capitalism live in it and are surrounded by it. Mm-hmm. It's a popular meme of a young person at an airport with a sticker on her laptop, which says, "Destroy capitalism." The laptop is from Apple. The phone is from Apple. Her coffee that she's drinking is from Starbucks. And she no doubt bought the clothes that she is wearing. On the other hand, it is ironic that the Internal Monetary Fund definition of capitalism includes the falsehood that its essential feature is to make a profit. In fact, the essential feature of capitalism is not to make a profit. It is to serve society. And that meme is so fun because she's obviously being well served by capitalism.
Right.
And enjoying it to some extent.
Mm-hmm. Humans invented capitalism.
Yes.
Guys, let's not forget that. We didn't invent it for malicious means or wants, right? We invented capitalism to serve the fundamental human needs of individualism and freedom.
And at Manager Tools, we believe in and stand by the idea that capitalism is a highly effective system for furthering the aims of humankind.
Absolutely. There's no other force in human history that has done more to make us as well off as we are today. That is, mankind is richer, it is stronger, it's taller, it's healthier, it's more long-lived, it's safer, it's more free. And capitalism and the economics that underpin capitalism is, to a large degree, the cause of all of this, right? One could argue that freedom and republican democracy have done so, right? That is, you could argue that it's the politics. And fair argument, you're right in some respects, until you realize that virtually every free and democratic society or group ends up becoming capitalistic.
Mm-hmm.
Individual humans, intuitively aware of their own natural born freedoms, seek to maximize their own health and wealth.
As evidenced by buying Starbucks coffees while you work on your beautiful laptop.
Exactly.
This seeking to maximize health and wealth leads to a free exchange of goods and services, which relies on the fundamentals of capitalism, such as comparative advantage and the pricing mechanism. You only need to read iPencil to understand this force and the fact of it in just one small industry.
Right. Pencils. Very small. Yeah. Very, very discreet in what they do. They create pencils. But if you read that, is it an essay? I think it's an essay, officially.
Yeah. That's a good way to.
You can buy it on Amazon. It's cheap. It's very easy to read. It's actually quite a fun read, too. iPencil. We recommend.
Yeah. So if we accept that the exchange of goods and services is capitalistic, and we have already accepted it, y'all. So if you want to go ahead and accept it, that would be great. Mm-hmm. Then even nonprofit and not-for-profit and government and educational systems, organizations, if you will, exist within that capitalistic system. It's one you can say we're not-for-profit or we're nonprofit, and that doesn't mean that you do not exist in a matrix, if you will, of capitalistic in organizations. There's a capitalistic environment in which these different organizations who are saying, no, we're not capitalistic, exist. Systems thinking and studies of organic life tell us that members of a society, which organizations are, must be in harmony with their environment to survive.
Yeah. And you mentioned this a minute ago, Kate. You talked a little bit about nonprofits. At this juncture, it would be reasonable for many professionals in the nonprofit space, right, to rail against the realities of these principles. That is, they want to be outside of the capitalism that many decry. Yet, their organization is surrounded by, just as much as all of the other organizations, frankly, even embedded in a capitalistic society. That is, their nonprofit responds every day to capitalistic forces around them. those organizations only survive, continue to survive, I suppose, if they show enough value to the donors to continue their work. Mm-hmm. And if they don't, their capital, a word which capitalism is derived from, their capital dries up and they cannot pay their associates, nor can they complete their nonprofit mission. Donors are a member of a larger free capitalistic system. And thankfully, for all of us, we have choices. And without choice, there's no freedom. And without choice, there's no ability to donate to nonprofits. And so nonprofit organizations seek harmony and stasis within their environment to continue that mission.
If you think about this, it's for this reason and others that all organizations adopt internally the principles of capitalism in their workings. The internal systems of your organization are dominated by the principles of freedom of choice, freedom of association, the pricing mechanism, and individual assessments of cost and benefit analysis. Mm-hmm. If you think, for example, about some simple ideas that we all kind of take for granted, for the thought process here, it's maybe helpful to consider that you probably pay more for things that you value more. This isn't to say, I absolutely do. This isn't to say necessarily that they are by definition more valuable.
Right.
But if we pay more for one thing than another, our behavior in the system defines our estimation of its value to us. Mm-hmm. There's stuff that I'm willing to pay more for and things that I'm not fussed if, you know, I can pay less and get something at a lower cost. For example, CEOs get paid more than other executives. And this is because organizational history has shown us that CEOs make a much greater difference in the organizational success than do other workers. This is implementation of a capitalistic principle inside an organization. The fact that CEOs are paid higher than other team members.
Right, than others. And let's at this juncture take a little segue here. Because the fact that CEOs make more than others within organizations is a hot topic. It's been something that's been in the media. People are outraged about CEO salaries, etc. So let's go a little bit deeper into that specific topic. Small segue. We'll get back to the point, I swear. But more on CEO pay. It's really popular to decry the amounts that CEOs are paid. And as an aside, aren't we lucky to be free enough to think, speak about, protest, and get angry if we wish about the fact that they make far too much money? Now, again,
it's a nice freedom.
It's a nice freedom. And we said before, remember, that very freedom created the marketplace that pays CEOs what CEOs are paid. CEOs are not overpaid.
Right. Yeah, because the marketplace for CEOs is paying them.
Yeah.
It's nothing more than the pricing mechanism, which we all rely on every day in our personal lives, at work on internal systems.
Right.
I think, Sarah, to further your, I wouldn't even call this a tangent, but to further this discussion, most people I don't think have any sense of the history of CEO pay. If you are looking at what was the average CEO of a Fortune 500 company paid in 1972, that was around $30,000 a year. You can read plenty of screeds against CEO pay that have been written since the 1970s. And CEO pay has skyrocketed relative to the average worker paycheck. This leaves out, though, that from 1955 to 1975, worker pay increases vastly outstripped CEO pay and closed that gap significantly. Further, in the 70s, we were only beginning to have enough data, roughly 40 years, so perhaps, what is that, 5 to 8 CEO tenures, to determine that CEO effectiveness was highly correlated with organizational performance. Huh. The gap between worker pay and CEO pay will close further in the coming years because of our recent brush with the pandemic. That changed individual choices on employment and highlighted the need for hourly workers to help keep economies alive. So you know, you can think about the history here. We're adapting. It's almost like we're learning lessons and then adapting our learning.
We're getting better and we're improving. So fun.
Hey, folks, October 25 and 26 this year in Chicago, again this year, 2022, is our M conference. We have had in the last couple of months some really exceptional talks on various topics from executives within our community, folks who will be coming to the M conference and have an opportunity to share through our speaker series. We have one each month. As soon as you sign up for the M conference, you get to attend the speaker series. We're actually having a special one this week where a good friend of mine who happens to be a PhD in blockchain is giving a talk to about 50 of our executives explaining blockchain to them. If you don't understand blockchain, you're normal. On the other hand, if you don't understand blockchain, you're at risk. So we decided we'd put something together for those folks who are attending the M conference. And if you sign up for the M conference now for our 2-day event, you could start coming to the speaker series right away. Hope you'll consider it.
So now back to another example in terms of our content. There is also a marketplace at play within our organizations for hiring.
Mm-hmm.
That's another example, right? Companies pay this pricing, what they believe to be a fair amount for any given role. Now, don't take your offer amount for a role lightly.
Sure.
This is a complex set of calculations that is done by larger organizations. They need to compare the relative benefits and costs of paying less, perhaps then when paying less, getting less talent, then potentially if the salary is not enough, no talent whatsoever because no one accepts the offer because it's too low, or on the flip side of that, paying more. And maybe that means they get more talent, but at the expense of failing to continue to operate in the future because the inability to price their goods competitively pushes them out of the market.
Sure.
Right? Continuing to operate is an organic and thus organizational imperative. In the same way, we all buy food before almost all of the other things on our list of wants because self-preservation is human. It's organistic and it's an imperative.
One might argue that a company with a great culture could potentially pay less for high quality workers, which seems to suggest, hey, it's not all about money. And this is actually true. Capitalism and the economics that underpin it are not just monetary math. It's way more than that. If you've ever been in one of those meetings where you're determining salary for people or raises, right? Mm-hmm. That's typically where we kind of see that. You know this. There are so many more bits of, I almost want to say data, but that's not really right because we've got so many people who actually work in bits of data. There's just so many things going on here. There's so many byplays, so many interactions. Y'all, we are free and we can choose to associate with whomever we choose. Some of us are willing to pay, air quotes there, the difference of taking less salary in return for working at a not-for-profit or nonprofit whose mission excites us. You can go work at that place. It is not all about money. This is really similar to us, some of us, not us, some people, wearing $5,000 watches and the other groups maybe wearing $10 watches or maybe no watch at all. Or it turns out you can buy for $500 jeans that are ripped and torn rather than $30 jeans that are free of holes that will eventually, should you wear them enough, become ripped and torn. These choices are perfect examples of free choice, and these are capitalistic choices. Not all capitalistic calculations are solely about money. Some people want to look cool. And further, Nobel Prizes have been awarded in the last 40 years 5 times. To behavioral economists, which I love behavioral economics. It's one of my favorite sciences. Of those prizes, the first, Herbert Simon, won his Nobel Prize for his work, which studied internal organizational decision making. Ta-da! Richard Thaler, whom I have sat next to some people who know him on a plane and had a very, very interesting conversation, won his Nobel Prize, partially, for his theory on predictable irrationality, which is human behavior, predictable irrationality. Neither, that doesn't sound scientific or monetary, and it is. It's both a fundamental part of capitalism, economics, and organizational life. Yeah, your boss seems irrational a lot, and she might still be making good decisions.
Absolutely, absolutely. In our capitalistic individual lives, we make such economic choices as this every single day. And because we're making these choices all the time, if our organizations are going to survive, they need to reconcile their choices with the powerful effects of freedom and capitalism and economics. And yeah, even irrationality, because we are irrational creatures.
Absolutely.
Capitalism, it's an entirely reasonable choice for managers and leaders in your organization to rely upon in making choices and trade-offs that happen internally in our organizations to then leverage capitalism, right? It makes total sense. Why wouldn't you make that comparison? You're part of an internal economy surrounded by forces that most of us have not studied, and many of which are not even obvious to us in our day-to-day work. But that doesn't mean they don't exist.
Mm-hmm. They do.
They do. They absolutely exist. And while we may not see them in an outward and obvious fashion, effective managers learn about them and harness them to their and the organization's advantage wherever they possibly can.
And we want to help you do that in work mm-hmm. reporting, coaching, and delegation. And we're going to start with in work reporting.
Yes.
Again, in 2010, when we mentioned managerial economics, that was over a decade ago. Here's a refresh on that. A change has occurred over 100 or more years in how work happens. It used to be that much of work was physical or visible. An apprentice or journeyman or someone brought the result of their work to the master or foreman once that work was completed, and work was specialized, but not automated or mechanized yet. And so the work of several had to be like physically combined into a finished product. No apprentice or journeyman would finish a task, say a vamp on a shoe or, you know, a specific cut in a woodworking piece, and then not give it to the master, right. Master cobbler perhaps, to be checked against the last. What would be the point? Might be the thought of that apprentice where we'd ask him today to finish his work but not give it to his boss. And that same apprentice might also add, I sit 5 feet from the guy. I don't need to tell him it's done. He can see it. Haha.
Right?
Because back then when work was first becoming specialized, managers didn't assign the communication of status with work because it was inherent in the nature of the work. But today, work has changed drastically. Unfortunately, we're still managing the old way, which is we assume that people realize that communication is associated with their completion. We're only assigning tasks nowadays and ignoring the necessary burden of communicating status, which is now truly a separate activity as opposed to before when they were inherent. And should anyone doubt that the communication of status is inherent in work assignments, consider the entire industry of web-based project tracking for software development. That industry's primary product allows companies to track development work across offices and continents and versions and people and managers and so on.
It's
and
a growing
so
industry.
Forth. Because the work is more complex and it's more fragmented and it's invisible and y'all, other people consume your work when you're done with it. That's still true. Companies are spending money to track work because we as managers don't understand it's part of our job to do it ourselves, and so we aren't doing it.
Exactly. So then, from there, we went on to define one of the simplest, smallest uses of managerial economics as Managerial Economics 101. That is, let's address the question of who should actually do the tracking of the work. Now, right now, there are folks sitting out there listening to this who, most of you, do the work yourself, rather than assigning work and the reporting of its status. What you do, what's natural, I find, the suite that comes with a human 1.0 version, is you just assign the work, right? That's what you do. You assign the work. When you need to know of status, what's going on, how's the work going, is it completed? You then go and find out, which means you send an email, or you make a quick phone call, or you send a text message, or the next time you see the direct responsible, you inquire about it verbally. And this can take us as managers anywhere from a couple minutes, even up to a couple of hours.
Yeah.
Tracking down status, which let me also add, is only compounded by the fact that we're virtual and talking and seeing each other less often, mm-hmm. that it takes time to get this status. Now, if we discount the value destruction of you not knowing, and that is really where most of the value is destroyed.
Right, that productivity gap.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, if we discount the value destruction of you not knowing, what we're left with is the amount of time we spend tracking down the status of this work. And Managerial Economics 101 tells us that if a manager and a direct can both accomplish a task, it's more effective for the direct to do it. The direct is cheaper labor. No. Okay, yeah, I know.
Now it's not someone's cool. Mad.
I know, right? I shouldn't have said it. Yes, it's
we've
not
angered.
Cool.
Yeah.
But it's just a term, cheaper, that we're stealing from, in this case, economics, right? From
right.
Capitalism. That is, we care about people. We all know that. If you're listening to this cast, you inherently, as part of being a manager in the Manager Tools community, care about your people. But managerial economics principles demand that we consider the costs associated with those people. We managers create cost when we do work that our team could do on our behalf.
Yeah, we have these kinds of discussions a lot, right? We have internal resources. Maybe you have internal resources and you choose to assign things to them rather than your contract people because you know that that's an out-of-pocket expense. We have conversations like that internally. You know that when we say cheaper labor, what we mean is if you exist in an organization in which managers are compensated at a higher rate than their directs, there is an inherent economic equation there around who does the work, how long that work takes, and not just who does it this time, but going forward, right? This is,
right.
We're going to get there when we talk about delegation.
We're totally going to get there, not to even begin to mention the stealing from your direct to their learning, their ability to grow. I mean, we've got all these things that are at play, but
Cost is one of them. And okay, so now if you're dying for the actionable guidance here we go. How do we do this? Welcome to Manager Tools. Brief your team on how you're going to change how you assign work to include the reporting of the work while teaching them about the difference between tasks and deliverables. It sounds like this. I am going to start assigning responsibilities differently going forward. Generally, I've done what most managers do. I've assigned you a task or a responsibility directly and specifically. I try to assign deadlines for the work. I'm going to try to start assigning you both the work and the responsibility to report on it. What does that mean? Before, I might have said, I need the client file updates by 2 p.m. tomorrow. Now, instead, I'm going to say, notify me that the client files have been updated by 2 p.m. tomorrow. It might seem like a small change, but it's actually pretty big for me. I spend a lot of time tracking down status. Often, you're done with a task, but I don't know it, and that's waste and lost time and resources. I think everyone pretty much knows that if you've done your work, you ought to be letting other people know that it's done. Frankly, it's always been true that work responsibility includes status reporting inherently, but we all get busy, and on a task that takes a day, if I don't check up for a week, it's likely done, but myself and others don't know that it is, which may hold myself, the team, or you up. So now, when I assign both work and the reporting of it, it won't be enough to say, oh, I already did that. That of what you're talking about cannot be done if it's not communicated as done. It's a small thing, big consequences. I don't want to have to track you down. And you ought not want everyone not knowing what it is that you're doing and what you've finished. Yeah, sure, it's going to be a little weird in the beginning. And I'm not always going to ask precisely enough. So let's be clear. Even if I don't ask, the standard here is that work responsibilities include prompt reporting of the work as well as the status. If you haven't told others, particularly me, that your task is completed, it doesn't matter if you've done it. I will not consider it done. Done means reported on. Simple as that. Done and not reported done is not done.
Yeah, really good. So just quickly here, I want to mention that was a really long script, which we recommend that you potentially read and or say to your directs if you're a licensee. That is all written in the show notes. You can go ahead and print it off if you're not a licensee. Note, if you become a licensee, those types of things are already written down and you don't have to pause and rewind Kate and feverishly try and type down all of the things that she just said.
With our fast talking.
Exactly. Now, let's go back. Kate used an example earlier. Let's go back to that example to help us further clarify. The example that she used, how work was done before the Industrial Revolution in a cobbler's shop specifically. Now, if the cobbler, whom again didn't have to assign work and reporting, knew that the work was done because the other person was sitting directly beside him at a bench. If the cobbler became prosperous enough to hire an apprentice other than his children, and they used an early version of both the specialization of labor and assembly line, when the apprentice finished his part of the shoe, we'd bet he brought the last, or heel, or vamp, or whatever it is, to the cobbler, rather than the cobbler having to go and get it from the apprentice. Now, let's imagine, put yourself back in the olden days. Let's say you're the cobbler. That's how you'd do it, right? Of course you'd want him to just bring you the shoe so you could finalize it and you could do the things that you had to do and finish it up. It just makes sense. And it's somehow something that we've lost, right? That natural knowledge of next communicate is just something that has gotten away from us.
Yeah, and it's tough because, again, it comes to my mind as really economical, right? Like, if somebody has to go and take the shoe somewhere, you don't send the cobbler, unless, of course, it's like your most high-profile client, right? You send the apprentice, and that's, again, an economic choice because the cobbler's time costs the organization or the cobbler's shop more, right, than the apprentice. And all of this, y'all, is a distinction about economics. By the way, just for fun, if we were to go back, like just over 200 years ago, there weren't right and left shoes. All shoes were just shoes, left, right, interchangeable. And undifferentiated shoes are called straights. The man who was credited with the mechanization of shoe manufacturing was Marc Brunel. Brunel. And he is the father of Isambard Kingdom Brunel, which was ranked as the second greatest Briton of all time, just below Churchill and above, by the way, Lady Diana, who I don't think would ever wear a straights shoe.
Oh, goodness. I'm no Lady Diana, and I definitely wouldn't. It sounds horribly uncomfortable. Doesn't mean it wasn't useful at some point in human evolution.
For sure.
All the things they're learning. Thanks, everyone. That's all we have time for this week. We'll be back next week with continuation of today's topic. Have a good one.